Now, our next speaker is Dr. Patricia Chamberlain, and she's Executive Director of Community Programs at the Oregon Social Learning Center, which, as Dave said, is one of our best centers for doing research on juvenile crime in the country. Dr. Chamberlain's treatment foster care program that she's describing today was selected as one of 10 national blueprint programs for violent prevention in the United States Department of Justice. Her program is going to be replicated in 10 communities across the country. She's had several grants. She's currently PI of a grant from the National Institute of Mental Health on female delinquency, which is an area where we need more research. Her CV includes over 40 publications in scientific journals on topics like foster care, community alternatives to incarceration for chronic juvenile offenders, and the role of parents and peers, their influence in juvenile crime. She's given presentations all over the country, all over the world, including Belgium, Mexico City, Sicily, Sweden, Vancouver, and now you can add Madison, Wisconsin to that list. In fact, she's just stopping off in Madison today on her way to Toronto to spend a couple days up there doing some training on her program. You know, she also has a very interesting career trajectory. She hasn't been a potter or a fireman, but she has a BS in secondary education, a master's in special education, and a PhD in educational psychology. She worked for 5 years as a special education teacher of emotionally disturbed children. She's worked as a school psychologist. She's been a university instructor. She's a licensed psychologist in the state of Oregon, and she serves as a clinic director. She tells me that she's a mother. She has 2 grown children and 1 Welsh Terrier who's still at home. Right? And her topic today is community alternatives for chronic juvenile offenders and emotionally disturbed youngsters, implications for the foster care system. We really appreciate you taking time to come today, Dr. Chamberlain. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks very much. I was raised in Chicago, and my sister was in college in Madison, so I've visited here often, but this is the first time I've ever worked in Madison, so I'm happy to be here this morning. My group and I started working in 1983 to figure out ways to keep teenagers out of jails and out of institutions. As Dr. Riley alluded to, we at the Oregon Social Learning Center have always been interested for some reason in the really antisocial kids, the kids who are sort of at the top of the heap when it comes to getting in trouble. So we were trying to figure out what are some ways that we can help these kids, keep these kids from going into these very restrictive kind of settings. And actually, I don't know why we were doing that, because what was going on in the state at that time is that there were a lot of prisons being built. So we were sort of going against the trend there. And as a matter of fact, in my county today, we have just completed a huge juvenile detention center, and we only have money to run a third of that center. So there's 2/3 of that center that are just sort of sitting there waiting for kids to come in. So anyway, we're not being very good citizens by trying to keep kids out of the jail, I guess. But at any rate, I'm going to talk today about treatment foster care, which is an alternative model where kids are placed in families as opposed to in group care kind of situations. And I'm going to address 5 separate kinds of questions around that model. Is it safe and feasible to treat chronic juvenile offenders in community homes? I mean, it seems like kind of a crazy idea when you think about putting these tough kids who have histories of a lot of arrests in, you know, community families. So that's one question. Compared to group care, which is typically what happens with these kids, how does being in treatment foster care stack up when it comes to looking at arrests and follow-up? Is treatment foster care cost-effective? Who does it work for? And finally, are there things that we've learned from working on this treatment foster care model that we can apply to regular foster care? Okay. Before I do that, though, I just want to give you a little bit of a brief on what is this treatment foster care thing. Treatment foster care is an alternative to group or residential care, where we recruit community families, give them a lot of training and support, place 1 child in each home. While the child is there, we're working very hard with their biological or adoptive or whoever they're going to go home to after the placement. We're working with those people so that they can make the changes necessary when the program is over, that the child has made gains, that they can go home and maintain those gains. As I said, the treatment foster families are provided with a lot of intensive support. And that includes daily telephone calls from program staff where we collect data on the child's behavior during the past 24 hours. We focus on the little things in treatment foster care. One of the ways that we deal with kids that are having severe problems in community homes is that we keep right on top of what's going on, basically. And, you know, oftentimes in corrections kind of a situation, juvenile corrections, what happens is that a lot of little indicators, a lot of little things will go wrong. The kid will cut school, they'll come be late, they'll be very defiant and disobedient, but none of those things are breaking the law, so the system doesn't take any action. So you get a lot of buildup of little things, and then finally, when the bad thing happens, the hammer comes down. And sometimes even that isn't that consistent. But we don't think about it that way. We're into looking at the small stuff and following through at that level because we feel like that's what these kids need in order to make the kind of changes in their very problematic patterns that are needed. And families are the good way to do that from our point of view. Foster parents come to a weekly meeting where they get ongoing training, supervision, and support. We have program staff on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for crisis intervention. And we tell our treatment foster parents, don't wait till it's a crisis. If you think about calling us, call us. So that's, that, again, focusing on the little things, focusing on things at the concern level as opposed to at the problem level, as opposed to at the crisis level. Foster parents get regular respite as well. One question is, how do you get parents to do this? You know, I mean, you'd have to be insane to volunteer, you know, to take a kid that has 13 arrests into your home. We use an advertising approach for getting foster parents. We recruit all the time. Here's an example of, you know, my advertising person, we're constantly going back and forth because I think some of the stuff that she does is pretty tasteless, you know. But I'm going, no, you can't do that. She says, Patty, if you can't get them to look at the ad, you know, you're not going to be able to get them to call. So she does a lot of stuff that is pretty shameless. Here's another example. This is on the following up on the Welsh Terrier thing. So we'll do it. I mean, we are pretty shameless for recruiting. We do it often, and we use all kinds of techniques to get families to join. I will say, as you establish a program like this and as you get it going, recruiting becomes much easier over time because you have your families out there and people can see what it's like. And so we have one of our best ways of recruiting is that if foster parents bring us a family that we eventually place a child with, then we pay them a finder's fee for doing that. Okay. I want to talk today, I'm going to show you some data about these that relate to these five questions. So I want to give you a little bit of an orientation about who are we talking about with these data. We did a study from 1990 to 1996 with 80 boys referred from juvenile justice. They were 14 on average when they came into the study. They had 13 previous arrests, almost one a year, you know, including 4.6 felonies. And these were kids who had been placed outside of their homes in some kind of treatment program a little over once on average each, and that doesn't include previous detention stays. And many of these kids, as you would imagine, were having significant problems with school. Okay, the way that the study worked is that after kids were referred to us, they were then randomly assigned to participate in treatment foster care or group care, and I'll describe the group care to you in a second. The reason for this random assignment thing is, in order to do a study that has any credibility, you need to do that. You need to have your people put into your group through not so that you're picking them. Otherwise, people would say, well, you know, you're just picking the easy ones out of that group, and you sent the hard ones to the other guys. So randomly we pick our kids, they either come to treatment foster care or they come to group care. Then they go in the placements. Once they're in there for 3 months, we go out and we do an assessment. And during that assessment at 3 months, we were looking at four things that we thought would predict arrests in follow-up. And I'm going to just hold that idea about four things, and we'll talk about that in a second. Those things, those key variables, are things that we took a lot of time measuring, and we looked at, after we looked at the outcome for the studies, we looked at how do those four things relate to the results. So then we did follow up at these various points of time. The four things were, how well was the child supervised? What kind of consistent follow-through did they have if there were rule violations? Small stuff. Not, you know, not breaking the law. But what if they didn't come home on time? What if they didn't go to school? You know, the daily kind of problems that all teenagers have. What was the response to those? What kind of a relationship did they have with a key adult living there with them in their placement setting? And how much time did they spend hanging out with other kids who were delinquent? We thought that if you knew the answer to those four questions, whether or not the kid was in group care or treatment foster care, if you knew the answer to those four questions, you would be able to predict what the arrest picture looked like in follow-up. Okay, the group care programs that we compared the treatment foster care to were your typical kind of group programs. There were 11 of them around the state. They varied from having 6 to 16 kids living together in a group. They varied from a family-style group home to more of a residential care center on a larger campus. Most of them had in-house school programs. They, most of them used a peer sort of control strategy. Positive peer culture. Peers were important in teaching kids, you know, skills and confronting kids when they did things, you know, when they broke rules and deciding discipline and so on. Lots of group therapy. Lots of contact with peers. Lots of emphasis on peer training, peer learning. In treatment foster care, completely different model. Lots of emphasis on parent to kid. No emphasis on peer-to-peer. Matter of fact, we did everything that we could. When we had our foster parent meeting and it wasn't a school day, we didn't have our kids in school, and we'd have our kids in the waiting room all together. We hate that. We have to figure out another way to do that. We don't want these kids getting together and hanging out together, because one of the hypotheses of our model is that there's a lot more negative learning that's going on between the lines than any positive learning that you might get out of it. Now remember, we're talking here not about your normal everyday teenagers. We're talking about your pretty hardcore chronic delinquent kids. Okay, so let's get to the first question. Is it safe and feasible to treat chronic delinquents in community families? Kind of a hard sell idea, actually. But if you look at the data, we found just on the most sort of surface level, how many kids complete their program who actually walk through the door? How many of those kids complete? And we see in treatment foster care, you had over 70% of the kids completing the program. That means they didn't run away and they weren't taken out because they committed another crime. Whereas in group care, you only had a little over 30% of the kids completing the program. So from a community safety point of view, if you put them in treatment foster care, they're more than twice as likely to stick in that program. In terms of running away, you get much lower runaway rates in treatment foster care, and this is pretty much a no-brainer if once I got what was going on. If you run away and you're in group care, you usually take somebody else with you. You know, so they like take the whole, everybody's gone. Whereas if you're in treatment foster care and you decide to run away, it's just you, you know. So, and I think that also relates to the reason why it's less likely that it'll happen, because, you know, you're out there on your own. You know, my colleague John Reed has a little saying. He says, you know, it takes more than one teenager to have a really bad idea. And I think that's probably so. Okay, now if we look at from the time kids came into the program to 1 year after they get out, okay, so now we're talking about how many days did they spend in detention? Treatment foster care spent an average of a little over 30. See, we're not, this is no magic bullet here. But relative to group care, treatment foster care kids spent a lot less days in local detention facilities. Again, about half as many days, a little better than that. And same deal with state training schools. So, you know, the idea would be first you'd go to local detention, and then if you continued to offend, then you'd go to state training school. So that's sort of a step up in intensity. So you're seeing even better comparisons in state training school. Now, if we look at how many days do these kids actually spend with their parents on average, treatment foster care has significantly more days than they're actually spending with their own parents, not the treatment foster parents, than the kids in group care. Okay, now we're looking at, now we're going to slip into the second question, which looks at effectiveness. How does it stack up in terms of arrests and follow-up? The period of time that we're looking at here is the time from when kids got out of the program through 1 year follow-up. And we see that before treatment foster care, the year before, kids in treatment foster care had a little over 8 arrests during that year before. Remember I said that they had 13 arrests on average, these kids in the study, but in the 365 days before they came in, the treatment foster care kids had a little over 8 arrests during that year. And in the year after, it was about 2.6 arrests on average. So we got a nice reduction in the amount of arrests after having been in treatment foster care. In group care, you get a slight and non-significant reduction in arrests. They go from a little over 6 to a little over 5 in follow-up. If another way to measure delinquency, and actually a much more sensitive way than arrests, because when we look at these data that I'm showing you here, these are self-report data. And self-report data are when you give a kid a questionnaire, there's a questionnaire that's used as a standard kind of a measure in a lot of these studies, and you ask them, during the past 3 months, did you do any of these things? And it's all manner of crime and mayhem. And then you ask them, and how often did you do it? When you give that kind of a questionnaire, and you look at that relative to arrests, you get about 9 times as many behaviors reported in a self-report questionnaire as you do arrests. I mean, it makes sense. Kids don't get caught for most of the stuff that they're doing. So self-report of delinquent behavior, as long as it's a confidential interview that you can feel assured that the kid is thinking that, you know, nobody's going to know about what I'm telling you, interviewer, can be a more sensitive measure than arrest. And the long and the short of it is that on three major scales, general delinquency, index crimes, which are serious crimes, and assault-type crimes, we get significant differences with treatment foster care having lower rates in all three of those areas in self-reported delinquent behavior. So if we ask the question, is it feasible and safe to place chronic offenders in community foster homes? I think, you know, you can give a qualified yes if the treatment foster parents are well trained and supervised, if they're given daily support and 24-hour, 7-day-a-week on-call staff available to them, if your youth correction system backs up your program. You know, a key part in our program was that we work very closely with parole and probation so that if we have a kid that people feel afraid of or that is showing dangerous behaviors, because when you deal with this population of kids, you will have that happen, that we can pick up the phone and that we can get immediate action on putting that kid in detention. Sometimes that kid will be in detention for a day and come back out. That's the most common kind of scenario. But you want to have that level of support behind you. Otherwise, you're kind of out there by yourself, and that's pretty scary. And that you can ensure that 4 things happen, 4 key program elements. These relate to these 4 mediators that I talked about. And we have done a lot of path analyses and these complex statistics and stuff showing pretty much that these 4 things are what matters. No matter what kind of a treatment program you use for this population of kids, you need to know where the kid is. You know, delinquency is a social activity. 80% of juvenile crime happens in the presence of other kids. It's not that way for adult crime. 80% of adult crime happens solo. So if you know where a kid is and who he's hanging out with, that's very important. Consistent consequences, again, relating to what I just said about crime happening in groups, and then positive relationships with a mentoring adult. Okay, I'm going to have you skip that, and I'll just talk for a couple seconds about who does treatment foster care work for. Oh, let me just put the cost effectiveness stuff up here. Basically, there's a group in Washington who, unbeknownst to us, did a cost effectiveness study on our data, and I don't pretend to really understand the ins and outs of this, but they came to the conclusion that projecting how many offenses kids would have committed if they hadn't participated in the program, blah, 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 the cost of the program, and cost of crimes not committed, I mean, all this stuff. They came to the conclusion that by the time that a youth is 25 years old, participating in treatment foster care produced a net gain and victim cost avoided of $17,575. Sounded good to me. I don't know. And they said that the program cost was paid back in 2 years. A program like this, as you might expect, is reasonably, it's about $20,000 per kid to do this approach. So, you know, it's a significant investment, but according to these guys, it pays off in the long run. In terms of who treatment foster care works for, I just want to talk about this for a second. Let's leave that off. We have used this approach now with kids coming out of the state hospital because of severe emotional problems. That's a very difficult and challenging group to work with. The nice thing about the model is that you're not dealing with a group of kids that you have to consider the needs of other kids, so you can deal with the child as individuals. We've worked with younger kids who are emotionally disturbed, developmentally delayed adolescents, and as Karen mentioned now, teenagers in the foster care system. Okay, could you put that last slide up? We wondered if some of the things that we were doing in treatment foster care could apply to regular foster care. And so we did another random assignment study design. And what we did is for regular foster parents, we had them meet in groups, and we called them every day on the telephone. So we did this training and support piece. And we looked at, if you enhance the kind of training and support that foster parents get, can you reduce disruptions, leaving the home for negative reasons? And we did find a strong effect we reduced the number of failed placements in regular foster care, and we found a surprising effect that we weren't looking for. We also had fewer foster parents dropping out of providing foster care if they had that increased training and support. So I think my time's up. In conclusion, I'll just say that throughout working on this project, I have become just very impressed with the number of dedicated, competent families and communities that are willing to come forward and deal with these very difficult kids, and encourage that with training and support, they can really make a major difference for these kids. Thanks.